have held the symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
But after revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude. And the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The cities are the most important human habitat in the modern era. They show the extent of civilization, social life, and the blossoming of the capabilities of the citizens. Today, that geographical boundaries do not exist thanks to the modern communication technologies, better urban management techniques can be identified through sharing global experiences. The municipality of Tehran has been a pioneer in hosting international events since 2014 and has brought together academic and executive elites in the field of urban management from all over the world to provide a forum for exchanging urban experiences. The fifth edition of the Tehran Golden Adobe Global Award was held at a time that the whole world is hit by the spread of the coronavirus.
Amid the corona pandemic, we were in touch with the mayors of many major cities of the world to share experiences. We informed them about the tough situation of Iran, where it is hit by the cruel sanctions on the one hand and the corona problems on the other hand. We used urban symbols like Azadi Square to sympathize with those struggling with the pandemic. Via video mapping, we were the first city to sympathize with those hit by the virus in China's Wuhan.
Some distinguished foreign guests who were present at the closing ceremony of Tehran Golden Adobe Award also touched upon the role of urban management at critical times.
We have to think that COVID has imposed new expectations but also new realities, and we have to look at capacities for a new digital age. And finally, it's not only about capacities, it's also about the agency, the institutions. So we have to look at how government and institutions operate in this context and how we can look at more healthier, greener and equitable policies.
At the end of the ceremony, Tehran's Global Award for Urban Management in different categories was handed to the best project in the cities, regions, and local communities worldwide. Tehran Golden Adobe Award is a comprehensive, academic, non-profit initiative that specializes in international urban management research and exchange. However, due to the spread of the coronavirus, this edition focused on methods used by urban managers to cope with the pandemic. Human Abadi, Tehran.
In yet another effort to stop Saudi Arabia's devastating war in Yemen, this time 24 British Parliament members have urged Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to halt the country's arms sales to Riyadh. In a letter, they have underlined that up to £15 billion worth of UK-made arms have been sold to the Saudi regime since it launched a war on Yemen in 2015. The letter also cites a recent UN report on the situation in Yemen, adding that the war has already claimed 233,000 lives, while about 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Many political experts believe that the Saudi-led war is being perceived globally as unwarranted and genocidal.
The global perception now about the Yemen war, if nothing else, is that this was unwarranted and genocidal. I mean, there's no justification for it. And it was a Saudi assault, but orchestrated by UK and US military personnel. Officers were in the Saudi capital from the very beginning. And of course, all the weaponry that the Saudi military uses in this genocidal assault is US and UK military hardware.
Since 2015, the Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen have devastated much of the poor country's infrastructure, with the UN calling it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Half of Yemen's population is now on the brink of famine, many of them children. The country has also experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak and now struggling with an alarming COVID-related death rate. From the onset of war, many international rights groups and activists have slammed the West in general and the United States, Britain, France, and Canada in particular for their support for the Saudi-led coalition. They have repeatedly called on these governments to suspend weapon sales to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. In September, a UN experts group named Canada for the first time as the one perpetuating the conflict in Yemen by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. So far, international calls have fallen on deaf ears as not only Saudi Arabia continues with its bombing campaign and blockade of Yemen, but its Western backers too continue supplying the regime with lethal weapons. It seems that what matters to Western powers most is putting their profit out of arms exports to the repressive Arab regimes above human rights and the lives of millions of impoverished Yemenis.
The Democrat-led lower house of Congress has forced a second impeachment trial in the Senate for ex-President Donald Trump on charges of incitement of insurrection following the deadly protests inside Capitol Hill on January 6th. There is seemingly no chance that a supermajority two-thirds of the Senate, which is evenly split between both parties, will vote to convict Trump this time either. Recent polls show America is almost evenly split on if Trump deserves a conviction, meaning the trial will be yet another highly divisive political event.
I think Democrats are basically taking this opportunity to once and for all kind of like rally around that, like, this person is, like, you know, evil. He's bad for the system. This is a terrible president to send. They're really just trying to hammer down that you can't get away with this stuff. And the president, in his own words, really did, like, rile up these people to come to the Capitol and, you know, wreak havoc. It's more of, I think, what they're going towards is, like, you can't come here and touch us.
Analysts suggest that Democrats may be pushing the trial as a way to weaken the Republican Party by forcing Republicans to openly choose between pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions. Conservatives could be weakened by infighting for years. Trump remains incredibly popular among Republicans, but a conviction would forbid him from holding office and running for president in 2024. Given the record anger, disunity, and polarization, many wonder if a successful conviction could backfire and provoke even greater problems.
All it really does is creates a vacuum for another figurehead to kind of go in there and take control of this mob of quite literally fascists. This is like fascism in actual definition. And what this does is, you know, we know Trump is a con man. We know Trump was often, like, bumbling his way through things. He was kind of like, you know, a joke, a mockery of the system. This, unfortunately, creates a vacuum where someone more competent in terms of just, you know, oppression, repression, can take control of this vacuum that Trump is leaving behind.
New President Joe Biden is being criticized for allowing Congress to focus on a trial instead of creating legislation to cope with a raging pandemic and a once-in-a-century economic disaster. Many fear the controversial trial will eliminate willingness for bipartisanship in a Congress in which Democrats have only a very slim margin of control. That's a different agenda than Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days in 1933, when he rolled out 15 major pieces of legislation, which began the so-called New Deal and economic recovery. The trial will begin on February 8th, and must dominate the proceedings of Congress until its conclusion weeks later. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
They are clearly very different issues, but EU foreign affairs ministers have agreed the two main policy areas on which they want to make progress with the United States are climate change and the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The ministers have just concluded face-to-face talks on the subjects in Brussels.
From climate change to Iran and JCPOA, and the most important ones, the most urgent ones, and the ministers are ready for a new start.
That new start is necessary because of Donald Trump's hate-fueled anti-Iran campaign during the past 4 years. The former U.S. president pulled Washington out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions designed to try and cripple Iran's economy.
Firms across the European Union have made it clear they very much want to do business with the Islamic Republic. Economists say U.S. banking-related sanctions against Tehran are stifling that business.
There is now some optimism that change is coming because Joe Biden has indicated the U.S. will rejoin the nuclear accord, which was signed by Iran and six world powers in 2015 and underpinned by the United Nations. With the possibility that U.S. sanctions against Tehran will be lifted, EU businesses should prepare to start trading, experts suggest.
I think it probably makes sense to move now and to be one of the early players in the right framework, of course.
With a population greater than 80 million people, Iran represents a big opportunity for EU firms, it has been pointed out. The 27-country bloc, which is heavily dependent on energy imports, could also address fuel security issues.
Iran would have its energy fields, its gas and oil, which are huge, some of the biggest in the world, opened again to markets, in particular the European market, which would be, you know, a beneficiary of this.
Tehran says Washington can only rejoin the JCPOA if there are no preconditions. Since entering the White House last week, Joe Biden has already spoken with Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron about the nuclear deal. The big unknown right now is, will Biden be willing or able to stand up to those who want to see the agreement completely disintegrate? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey and Greece held their first direct talk in 5 years over tensions which grew between the two neighboring countries over the past years. Turkey has been at loggerheads with Greece and Cyprus over an energy-rich area in the Mediterranean Sea. Tensions flared up last year after Ankara deployed an exploration vessel to the contested waters. The move foundered plans for the resumption of Athens-Ankara negotiations that had been stalled since 2016. The two sides were still trading barbs in the days leading up to the meetings. Last week, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said his country will attend those talks with optimism, but, quote, zero naivety. Issues that are on the agenda of the delegations are bilateral disputes, maritime boundaries, and drilling rights.
In talks with Greece, we hope that the issues will be dealt with within the framework of rights, law, and equity, and that solutions are found. We hope that Greece respects our rights in the Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean and avoids actions that may cause misunderstandings.
The meetings were held with international optimism as well, especially from the EU. Analysts say this whole meeting was due to the bloc's pressure on both sides and voiced concerns over the delegations failing to reach an agreement.
The two sides met to agree on several points. Greece wants to discuss East Mediterranean and Turkey wants to discuss arming Aegean islands. Therefore, they will need more time to reach a common ground, and I think it's hard for both sides to reach an agreement, just like it was in the previous talks. I think the talks are being held mainly due to the EU pressure.
This is the 61st negotiations between the two, as talks were initiated in March 2002 and stopped in 2016 without reaching an agreement. Hopes seem high about the outcome of the talks, but given previous experiences, observers say the disputes between Turkey and Greece need more than this to be resolved. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Thank you. is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The U.S. President Joe Biden and the Russian President Vladimir Putin have had the first official contact, and there has been some strides made. First, an agreement on the New START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, a cornerstone of global arms control, was reached. Russia has also reiterated a stance that the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal. Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at the other issues that these two nuclear powers might share, like NATO and Ukraine.
Russia-U.S. relations have generally been tense, with their ups and downs since the end of the Cold War, dragging them into policies and sometimes even conflict. Now a new administration in the U.S. offers a glimmer of hope, with all eyes now on the direction of the bilateral ties the two countries could pursue. In one of the initial moves to reduce tension, U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin agreed to extend the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty for 5 more years. The agreement was failed to materialize under former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration insisted on a conditional renewal of the accord, which Moscow rejected. The Obama-era agreement puts a limit on the number of strategic nuclear warheads, missiles, and bombers Russia and the U.S. can deploy. The Russian president hailed Washington's move to extend the New START. However, he warned that the situation could still develop unpredictably.
The extension of the START Treaty is definitely a step in the right direction. But I repeat, the situation can develop unpredictably and uncontrollably if, of course, we do nothing to prevent this from happening.
The treaty, which was due to expire on February 5th, provided a rare opportunity for compromise between Moscow and Washington. However, the first phone call between Biden and Putin showed their bilateral disagreements are too wide to resolve. During the call, Biden raised concerns over what he called aggression against Ukraine and warned about Russia's meddling in 2016 U.S. presidential election. He also addressed the reports of bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan and recent massive cyber hack that has been blamed on Moscow, accusations that Russia has categorically denied. The conversation also included recent protests in Russia in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. This is while the Kremlin accuses the U.S. of promoting anti-government protests in Russia and interfering in its domestic affairs. Following the phone call, the White House, in a statement, reiterated the tough U.S. stance on Russia.
President Biden made clear that the United States will act firmly in defense of its national interests in response to actions by Russia that harm us or our allies.
The Kremlin also issued a statement about the conversation between the leaders of the two countries that underscored troubled relations as well.
President Putin noted that the normalization of relations between Russia and the United States would meet the interests of both countries, and, taking into account their special responsibility for maintaining security and stability in the world of the entire international community.
Can one expect a reset in U.S.-Russia relations while the Biden administration has already inherited thorny ties put in place by his predecessor, even with Washington's close allies? The world will be waiting and watching how Washington and Moscow manage their many differences and seek common ground to avoid escalatory confrontation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate is Richard Black, former Senator, Virginia State Senate, who joins us from Ashburn. We'd also like to welcome Daniel Kubalik, who's an author, lecturer, and lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Black, let me first start with you. So you have this phone call, and you have this initial contact between Putin and Biden. And, well, they had failed to agree an extension under former U.S. President Donald Trump. And I'm referring to the New START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. What did happen? What happened under Biden to have this come back that Trump rejected? What were the reasons?
Well, I think, first of all, the extension of the nuclear treaty was obviously a very positive thing. The Russians didn't ask for any preconditions. They just said, let's continue it and let's talk. I think it was a very wise decision for the Biden administration to say, yes, we will look and we will work towards extending it. One of the problems, I supported some things Trump did. I opposed others. I was not a fan of Mike Pompeo. I saw him as less of a diplomat and more of a bully. And his objective was to simply dismantle all of the nuclear treaties that were worked on for decades and decades by generations of good-hearted Americans and good-hearted Russians. So the fact that we're able to hang on to that one treaty, I think, is a very positive thing. Now, in the same conversation, Biden, he is subject to pressures from the deep state, from all of the corporate interests in war. And so he talked about the Navalny poisonings or alleged poisonings. And he raised those issues. He raised some other issues. Which will keep the deep state satisfied that he's not going to be too friendly. But I think at least there's reason for some hope and some optimism. There certainly is good reason to see improvement in our relations with Iran. And I think to some extent, the Obama administration continues to live on in some fashion. And they saw the JCPOA as being a very major development for them. And right. I think there's at least a hint that may still be in the works.
Okay, well, we're going to you touched on a number of issues there. We're going to break those down one by one if time allows us. So, Daniel Kovalik, let me come to you regarding NATO first, in no order of importance here. Biden sought to repair this strained relation that was between the U.S. and Europe by stressing Washington would abide by the NATO treaties, Mutual Defense Pact. Now, do you think that this means that the U.S. is going to continue doing what it's doing with NATO, in which Russia sees NATO as an entity that's encircling it, while at the same time provoking Russia with things like war games?
Yes, I do think that. I think NATO is a relic of the past. It should have been dismantled some time ago. I think Biden's statement that he plans on honoring the agreements with NATO does suggest exactly what you're saying, that Biden plans on continuing to poke the Russian bear, to surround Russia. NATO exists for one purpose and one purpose alone. It was created to counter the Soviet Union. It's been used since the collapse of the Soviet Union to try to counter Russia, and that's what it's going to continue to do, and Biden's making it clear that that's will continue.
Okay, so let's continue the path of NATO, Richard Black, in the form of Ukraine, in terms of having your input here. I'm guessing that Biden is going to want to have some kind of settlement or peace settlement on Ukraine. Of course, that issue is very contentious in terms of how he has said repeatedly that he wants to expand and possibly include, wants NATO to expand and possibly include Ukraine in that picture. How do you think that situation is going to evolve under Biden vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine?
The main thing that has made it awkward for him is the involvement of his son, Hunter Biden, in some very questionable financial arrangements with Iran. Hunter Biden was just sort of the tip of the iceberg. We have very powerful politicians in Congress whose family members have acquired enormous wealth. And much of that wealth has been by being involved in these never-ending wars, where the United States constantly appropriates money to DOD and CIA and State Department. That money is funneled unaccountably to different companies, and in some cases we see it working its way to people like Hunter Biden. So there's a tremendous vested interest in war. War is our business, and business is thriving. And so it's awkward in Iran, or rather in Ukraine, because we toppled the government in Ukraine some years ago, and we said, well, we're after democracy and so forth. But in fact, we really were looking for conflict and for moving that conflict much closer to the Russian border. But the whole idea of NATO, I certainly agree with your other commentator today. Russia outlived its usefulness and should have been abolished. They should have had a little march and given a medal to everybody in NATO and simply disbanded it at the end of the Cold War. When they didn't, they had to have an enemy. And even though Russia was not an enemy in any respect, it did not have an expansionist philosophy, it didn't have the economic wherewithal to threaten anyone, didn't have the population to do it, and yet it was very necessary to create this boogeyman to justify the tens of thousands of deep staters in NATO and to perpetuate the idea that somehow we had an enemy. We don't have an enemy. Russia is not an enemy. And the only thing that creates hostilities is the fact that we are edging troops right to the very borders of their territorial waters and land, and threatening Russia in a very, very dangerous way, reckless way.
So what about another issue, Daniel Kovalik? Again, one of many that was discussed between these two, and that's the issue of Iran. We know Russia's stance, how it stands on that. I'm not too sure if we understand U.S.'s stance, somewhat murky. But how do you think that Russia would, or how would the U.S. and Russia cooperate with each other when it comes to Iran, even though that is somewhat a moot point because Iran has made its stance very clear when it comes to the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, my hope is that Biden will re-enter that nuclear deal. Iran's made it clear they're willing to do it on day one. I think that will bring back down the temperature between the U.S. and Iran, and frankly bring down the temperature in the Middle East, so I hope that that happens. I think, though, that Israel and Saudi Arabia will be opposed to that, and we'll see if Biden is willing to stand up to those two countries. Trump was not. It's kind of the tail wagging the dog there, and I think it does remain to be seen whether Biden has the fortitude to do that. But I have some cautious optimism that he will, and that he is willing to work with Europe in honoring the nuclear deal, which, you know, Europe is still a party to. So, yes, I have some hope.
You had said, Richard Black, just minutes ago that you don't really see Russia, if I understood you correctly, to be the threat that it's been perceived to be, something that has been somewhat formed by the way that EU views Russia, perhaps, countries like the UK. And Russia, of course, has been accused of doing some things to make that scenario or to create that scenario.
But we're looking at Biden, who once called Putin soulless. I mean, do you think that Biden will approach Russia in an offensive way in terms of dictation? Or will it look it to be somewhat of an ally, which is very hard to actually conceive?
It is almost impossible to make an ally of Russia so long as we have this vast deep state of NATO operatives in place. All of them, their jobs, their wealth, their position, all depend on having an enemy. And so that is the problem with truly forming an alliance with Russia. In a world without NATO, there is no reason that Russia could not join and become an integral part of Western Europe. Their values are similar. In fact, their new constitution provides that marriage is one man and one woman. It provides for parents' rights over the upbringing of their children. These are things that Americans have struggled to get for generations and couldn't get, and yet they exist in Russia. Russia is totally compatible with Western Europe. They're trying to extend the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany. Germany wants it very badly. Russia wants it very badly. The United States is sanctioning and going contrary to the countries of the European Union on this issue. I see a very natural, very comfortable relationship if we were to drop the militarization. Some people say, well, look, Trump achieved something great because he got the NATO countries to increase their defense spending. For what purpose? Now, I can see some concerns about threats from Turkey, but I do not see any threat from Russia. Russia is no threat whatsoever to Europe, and the whole thing is just a piñata to give us something to strike at.
Okay, well, Daniel Kovalik, we talked about NATO here, we talked about Iran, we talked about Ukraine, but then we take a look at the issue of Navalny. Now, you know, when Russia has come out accusing the U.S. directly of backing demonstrations and protests for Navalny, then obviously that rattles the cage of Putin in a sense, if he does have a cage, and that's, you know, in a sense, an interference, if I'm correct to make that assessment. So it doesn't make grounds for what the Kremlin wants, which is a normalization of relations between Moscow and Washington. That's something the Kremlin has come out and said. So is there a limit as to the way these two countries are going to get along when you have the U.S. been accused of it, which, well, it has been accused of this accusation in other countries, which holds true?
Yeah, I mean, look, the U.S. claiming that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, which, by the way, I feel is a dubious claim, is at best the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, the U.S. has interfered, we know, in, 81 different elections throughout the world. This has been documented. And that doesn't even count the times that the U.S. has actually overthrown governments by force and by coups. So yes, I would not be surprised that the U.S. Was supporting these demonstrations. They're clear from the media that I listen to every day that they support Navalny, even though, frankly, I've seen some statements by him that suggest he's a right-wing racist. But again, that's not surprising. The U.S. backed neo-Nazis in Ukraine, you know. So, but yeah, as long as the U.S. decides it can meddle in other countries like Russia, but then takes umbrage at countries allegedly interfering here, I just think it's not a grounds for a mutual relationship.
There are other hot spots that these two countries need to figure something out on, Richard Black. One of them is Syria. They need to come to some kind of understanding on that. And of course, when we talk about West Asia, Middle East as it's called, then there also needs to be an understanding there, because Russia does not share all common interests with the U.S. when it comes to this region. How will that be resolved? And we could start by talking about Syria.
You know, the most insightful thing that I saw was put out by Atlantic Council not recently, Atlantic Council is very much a deep state organization, but their analysis was good. And they said that a couple of things. They said Tony Blinken, who is the proposed Secretary of State, has said that public support for U.S. hegemony is diminishing. He suggested that, at least in the short term, Russia and Iran will control the trajectory of events in Syria. Now, he did say that he was going to increase aid to the areas of Idlib province and the Kurdish-occupied northeastern Syria. Now, this means that we will be providing additional enhanced aid to al-Qaeda and to the terrorists that occupy Idlib province. Unfortunately, one of the saddest things is that we have had a consistent policy of starving the Syrian people. Through our sanctions and through devaluing the currency through the SWIFT system, we've created enormous inflation. We have cut off the Syrian people from their major source of wheat that they need for bread. We have stolen their oil, which they need to heat homes in the winter. We've even managed through our extensive sanctions to block the Syrians from receiving medicines to treat cancer and other diseases. Anyone who says that sanctions are designed to simply, twist the arms of wealthy, powerful politicians is a fool. Mm-hmm. The purpose of sanctions is to crack down on common people, and that's what they do.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We're going to have to end it there. That was Richard Black, former senator, Virginia State Senate. Thank you for your statements. And also, Daniel Kubalik, thank you, author, lecturer, and lawyer from Pittsburgh. That does it for this edition of The Debate. For Mikhail Itav, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Just near half of England's 59,000 vital flood defences are managed by a complex array of third parties, including government departments, local authorities and private landowners. The figures show that 8% of those managed by third parties are in poor or very poor condition, compared to 4% of those overseen by the UK Environment Agency. In the picturesque district of Hart in Hampshire, all of its vital flood defences are managed by third parties, and nearly half are in a state of ruin. We now present you an article written by Josh Halliday. The piece is titled "Swathes of England's Vital Flood Defences Almost Useless." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Stay with us for more of Josh Halliday's article. An investigation has found thousands of England's vital flood defences were in such a state of ruin last year they would fail to protect communities from extreme weather. More than 3,400 of England's high-consequence flood assets, defined as those that there is a high risk to life and property if they fail, were judged by the UK Environment Agency to be in such a bad condition they were almost useless. This means that more than 1 in 20 of the country's crucial flood defences were in disrepair in 2019-2020, the highest proportion in years. This rose to nearly 1 in 10 in the regions battered by Storm Christoph recently. The findings come from Environment Agency data obtained by Unearthed, the investigative arm of Greenpeace UK, and shared with The Guardian. Doc Parr, the chief scientist and policy director at Greenpeace UK, said, "The poor state of so many critical flood defences in England is putting thousands of people and thousands of homes at risk, and this is unacceptable. Most of Britain was placed under a weather warning for snow and ice after an Arctic blast of cold air hampered the recovery effort from Storm Christoph, which caused at least 600 homes to be flooded as 2 months' worth of rain fell in just 48 hours in some areas of England." The Environment Agency said its 2020 recovery program inspected more than 20,000 assets and that they were winter-ready either through repairs or, if not, robust contingency plans are in place. It said that 95% of its 78,000 flood assets, which range from embankments to culverts and tidal barriers, were not in good condition and that repairs were prioritized when there was significant threat to lives and livelihoods. The Unearthed analysis found that 3,460 of England's most important flood defences were judged by the Environment Agency to be in a poor or a very poor condition in 2019-2020. This accounts for 5.9% of the total, the highest proportion in years, up from 4% in 2017-2018. Of the 3,460, 791 were judged in very poor condition, meaning they had severe defects resulting in complete performance failure, essentially rendering them useless. The remaining 2,669 were in a poor condition, meaning they have defects that would significantly reduce their performance. Just under half of England's 59,000 vital flood defences are managed by a complex array of third parties, which includes government departments, local authorities and private landowners. The figures show that 8% of those managed by third parties are in either a poor or very poor condition, compared to 4% of those overseen by the Environment Agency. In the picturesque district of Hart in Hampshire, all of its flood defences are managed by third parties, and nearly half are in a state of ruin. Experts have warned that the United Kingdom faces an increased risk from more extreme and unpredictable weather owing to the climate emergency. Major floods had been expected every 15 to 20 years in the last century, but in the past decade this has shortened to every 2 to 5 years. The Environment Agency has said it needs £1 billion a year to build and maintain England's flood defences, significantly more than the £5.2 billion announced by the government for 2,000 new projects up to 2027. Parr urged ministers to increase funding to better protect England's flood defences and stop building on high-risk floodplains. He added, "We know that the climate crisis is making our winters wetter, increasing the risk of floods across the country. We've had warning of the climate threat for years, so there is no excuse for not being prepared." In the Midlands, South Yorkshire and northwest of England, where nearly 600 homes were flooded recently, 831 of these vital defences are in a state of disrepair, 9% of the total. According to Environment Agency data, in Cheshire, where at least 150 people had to be rescued by firefighters, 16% of high-consequence flood defences are in a poor or a very poor condition. Dan Jarvis, the mayor of Sheffield City Region, said residents would have to ensure sleepless nights due to a £125 million funding gap in its flood defence allocation from Whitehall. Dan Jarvis welcomed an additional £80 million given to the region recently for flood management projects, but said this was a sticking plaster over a much bigger wound. He has asked ministers for months to fund 27 projects that would protect 10,300 homes, 2,800 businesses, as well as crucial infrastructure in Sheffield. A spokesperson for the Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs claimed, "We know how flooding can devastate communities, which is why since 2015 a record figure of £2.6 billion has been invested in flood schemes, better protecting 300,000 homes, and over the next 6 years we are doubling that investment to £5.2 billion for 2,000 new defences to better protect a further 336,000 properties."
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.